morning, this Dos de Mayo day of 2024. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with homage to yesterday, May Day, which I wrote many May Days ago for the North Coast Times Eagle and is generally my annual tribute to the merry month of mayality on this program. May Day, a call for revolution, a call for change, a call for help. May Day, the ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect of all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. Oppression, tyranny, and corruption infect the world's governments. World leaders move pitilessly against their own peoples and their neighbors. Armies and police kill innocent people in retaliation for terrorist acts, which perpetuates terrorism. Populations are the major targets of wars, contrary to pious perfidy, which makes war itself a foremost and persistent act of enormous terrorism. The terror of nuclear annihilation looms iconically several years after the first atomic bombs obliterated two Japanese cities and gave birth to the nuclear age. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless as well as unwilling to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our opulent civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it. We will most likely strangle on the effluence of our affluence. The millennium is an X-ray of our history, which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon'd, but history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. This new millennium evokes old prophecies, apocalyptic cults that believe the end of history is at hand, flourish and seize theological power all over the world. Inexorable, bipolar dogmata armed with the means to achieve what ancient prophecy continues to incite. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. Yet optimism persists, perhaps because in even the worst of times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps in especially the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that was May Day, which I wrote for my newspaper and published it almost every year at this time. And now, from the New York Times, by Serge Schliemann, student protest is an essential part of education. Anyone who was at Columbia University in the spring of 1968 cannot help but see a reprise of those stormy, fateful, and thrilling days in what is happening on the Morningside Heights campus today. But there is a troubling and significant difference. If the students back in 1968 were divided into rebellious long-haired pukes and conservative close-cropped jocks, with a lot of undecided in between, the current protests at Columbia and at the growing number of other campuses to which they have spread have witnessed personal and often ugly divisions between Jewish students and Arab or Muslim students, or anyone perceived to be on the wrong, and that's in quotes, side of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That, in turn, has thrust the protests squarely into the polarized politics of the land, with politicians and pundits on the right portraying the encampments as dangerous manifestations of anti-Semitism and wokeness and demanding that they be razed, and many university administrations calling in the police to do just that. The transformation of the protests into a national political football is perhaps inevitable. Everyone up to President Richard Nixon sounded off about students in 68, but it is still a shame because student protests, even at their most disruptive, are at their core an extension of education by other means, to paraphrase Karl von Clausewitz's famous definition of war. The hallowed notion of a university as a bastion of discourse and learning does not and cannot exclude participation in contemporary debates, which is what students are being prepared to lead. From Vietnam to apartheid to the murder of George Floyd, universities have long been places for open and sometimes fiery debate and inquiry. And whenever universities themselves have been perceived by students to be complicit or wrong in their stances, they have been challenged by their communities of students and teachers. If the university cannot tolerate the heat, it cannot serve its primary mission. The counterargument, of course, is that without decorum and calm, the educational process is disrupted, and so it is proper and necessary for administrations to impose order. But disruption is not the only byproduct. Protests can also shape and enhance education. A disproportionate number of those who rose up at Columbia in 1968 went into social service of some sort, fired by the idealism and faith in change that underpinned their protests and by the broader social movement of the 1960s. I was a first-year graduate student at Columbia in 68, living in the suburbs, and so more of a witness than a participant in events of that spring. But it was impossible not to be swept up in the passions of the campus. The catalyst was a protest by black students over the construction of a gym in Morningside Park, which touched on many black grievances against the university, the way it was pushing into black neighborhoods, the gym's limited access and separate door for area residents, many of them black. The slogan was, Jim Crow must go, and that's spelled G-Y-M. The black sit-in quickly galvanized students from all other social and political causes of that turbulent era, a war that was killing scores of American boys and countless Vietnamese every week, racism that just weeks earlier took the life of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and yes, a celebration of flower power and love. The gym issue at Columbia was quietly resolved, but by then, other students were occupying several buildings. Finally, Columbia's president, Grayson Kirk, called in the police. I have a snapshot embedded in my memory of groups of students milling about the grounds, which were littered with the debris of the confrontation, many of them proudly sporting bandages from the injuries inflicted by the violent sweep of the tactical patrol force. Psychedelic music blared from some window, and a lone maintenance man pushed a noisy lawnmower over a surviving patch of grass. The sit-ins had been ended, and order was being restored, but something frightening and beautiful had been unleashed, a faith that mere students could do something about what's wrong with the world, or at least were right to try. The classic account of Columbia 68, the Strawberry Statement, a wry, punchy diary by an undergraduate, James Simon Coonan, who participated in the protests, captured the confused welter of causes, ideals, frustrations, and raw excitement of that spring. Beyond defining what it wasn't, it is very difficult to say with certainty what anything meant, but everything must have a meaning, and everyone is free to say what meanings are. At Columbia, a lot of students simply did not like their school commandeering a park, and they rather disapproved of their school making a war, and they told other students who told others, and we saw the at Columbia is our school, and we will have something to say for what it does. And that is from the Strawberry Statement by James Simon Coonan. That is the similarity. Just as students then could no longer tolerate the horrific images of a distant war delivered for the first time in almost real time by television, so many of today's students have found the images from Gaza now transmitted instantly onto their phones to demand action. And just as students in 68 insisted that their school sever ties to a government institute doing research for the poor, so today's students demand that Columbia divest from companies profiting from Israel's invasion of Gaza. And students then and now have found their college administrators deaf to their entreaties. Certainly, there is a lot to debate here. Universities do have a serious obligation to protect Jewish students from anti-Semitism and to maintain order. But it is to their students and teachers that they must answer, not to Republicans eager to score points against woke indoctrination, and that's a quote, at elite colleges, or to mega donors seeking to push their agendas onto institutions of higher learning. Like Mr. Coonan, I'm not sure exactly how that spring of 1968 affected my life. I suspect it forced me to think in ways that have informed my reporting on the world. What I do know is that I am heartened to see that college kids will still get angry over injustices and suffering and will try to do something about it. And that was, Student Protest is an Essential Part of Education, by Serge Schuman. He joined the New York Times, from which this has been taken, in 1980. And worked as the bureau chief in Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem and at the United Nations. He was editorial page editor of the great old International Herald Tribune in Paris from 2003 to 2013. And a personal footnote. I was at the anti-war uprising at Columbia University in spring 1968, not as a member of the protest, but as an NBC trainee with the Reporter TV news team. However, I was also a member of the fledgling Vietnam Veterans Against the War, which had just organized in New York City that spring of 1968. Two former U.S. Army Vietnam vets, Jan Crum and Carl Rogers, had begun the VVAW, and I became an early member after Vietnam service in the USMC a year and a half earlier. And now, something I wrote for my defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, Return of the New World Order. The 21st century is not the American century, despite the aspirations of the corporate imperialists who have usurped virtually absolute power in the USA. The business of America is business, infamously claimed President Calvin Coolidge, but ambitions parallel an even earlier Republican president, the first Roosevelt, who initiated the real American century more than a century ago. America was not founded to make money, Woodrow Wilson complained in 1919. It was founded to lead the world on the way to liberty. Political liberty, he said, is the right of those who are governed to adjust government to their own needs and interests. The USA is not a business or a corporation. It is a society, and that is very different, with clearly dissimilar needs and responsibilities. It is a democracy in design, which is contrary to the administrative elitism of a corporate entity. The real purpose of the American experience is that human beings are capable of coexisting as equals, that so-called free competition is not one of unfair or dominating advantage. Nor is a democracy healthy when enormous numbers of its citizens are unemployed, with poverty and homelessness their only prospects. The remedies for repairing and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe that has resulted from the past decades' government laissez-faire of business and corporate monopoly of the country are many and varied, and depend upon reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. Perhaps the colonial rebels who declared independence from their mother country more than two centuries ago had their own ambitious agendas, but they revived the ancient dream of living without shackles, of determining one's own life. The most famous sentiments of the Declaration of Independence virtually shout these long-thwarted desires that all men, though not women, and not all men either, as it turned out, are created equal, and that governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. In other words, a democracy, a government of equals. Even the infamous Robespierre could a few years later define democracy as a state in which the people, as sovereign, guided by laws of its own making, does for itself all it can do, and by its delegates what it cannot. And Bill Moyers wrote two centuries later that constitutional democracy is no romantic notion. It is our defense against ourselves, the one foe that can defeat us. Quote, unquote. Yet, in contrast to the premise, a constitution manifestly provides a reasonable guarantee of political equality. Listen to a group of workers in Sheffield, England, whose bitterness in 1741 sounds as if they were speaking about life in the U.S. today. What's the Constitution to us? if we are nothing to it. Conceived as a republic, governed as a democracy, and always dominated by men of wealth and privilege, the USA appropriated European capitalism at the very beginning and combined it with the nascent Industrial Revolution, also imported from Europe. The American system made financial barons of a few and wage slaves of the many. The practice of democracy has been less than its publicity, not completely a sham, but all too often a facade of liberty and equality. It has been treated as a vent for the little people to whimper and perhaps exercise a slim possibility to redress inequities between privilege and repression. Redress is extremely difficult to accomplish with no little bloodshed. The real power has always been with economic elites who rule as lords in a state dominated by wealth and the unvarnished ambition to attain it. The domestic decline of the USA is primarily the responsibility of the armed might that has made it the most powerful nation on the planet, as well as in history, but at great internal cost. As more of the nation's wealth is poured into the military, the more its productivity is absorbed into serving the armed forces and profiting weapons makers, and subsequent loss of competitive position in domestic and world markets. The obsession for world power, America's self-declared manifest destiny, has given it the Pyrrhic paradox of global supremacy and internal deterioration. Although military power has been the matrix of the USA's ascendancy, opening markets abroad as well as influencing the governance of other nations, its maintenance has been at the expense of domestic priorities that, until they are debauched, act as the cultural glue holding the country together. The military-industrial mafia of interlocking corporations and the Pentagon, that one of its most favored and famous beneficiaries, General of the Armies and President of the USA, Dwight Eisenhower, warned the nation about as a not entirely cynical farewell from public life, has created a black hole into which everything is eventually drawn and disappears, such as the nation's wealth and resources, with neither replaced. And amidst the flaming testosterone of a new world order managed by the USA, the infrastructure of American society has declined, with ever larger numbers of the nation's most useful citizens sinking deeper into unemployment and poverty. And freedom and liberty, always tenuous and unfairly distributed and always dependent upon equality of wealth, shrivels under assault by the privileged, who mercilessly loot the nation's substance and spirit as well as its fiscal treasure. The similarity between the world economy of the early 18th century and today's economy is starkly evident. Both periods experienced a breakdown of the open trading system, intractable international debt, German then, so-called developing world now, and rising internal debt, as well as widespread political and economic corruption. Most significant is that Americans have been hurt in both periods by a surface prosperity that concealed as well as propelled economic disaster while encouraging complacency about the national economy's underlying ills. With the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, and the eradication of communism from the major regions of the world, the exception being China, the USA rapidly moved into the power vacuum. The dramatic collapse of communist Russia in the 1990s set in motion forces that continue to change the scope and scale of world power, which are not mere strategic adjustments, but are immense historical realignments in the aftermath and vacuum of a vanished empire. This new era of rhetorical New World Order a term used by the 20th century's worst citizen, Adolf Hitler, to describe his own world vision, is an awesomely lopsided proposition in which the USA is the last reigning superpower, excluding China for the moment, moves to impose its will economically and militarily upon the world at large. Technology and globalization in this new century millennium, the impact of centralized mega corporate power, and the cachet of techno-utopianism with concomitant ancillary technologies such as biotech, nanotech, robotics, new mass media, and the vast web of mega technologies, which includes military weaponry, are rapidly forcing the planet toward unprecedented environmental, political, and social trauma. Bewildered, exhausted, and despaired by the cold realities and complexities of modern government and its unholy alliance with corporate avarice and military force, perhaps we should adhere to parsimony instead of surrender, patiently trace the confused, corrupt tentacles to their origins, and from that basic point, realize how we got off the track of the history we intended to navigate when our ancestors declared they could no longer abide the oppressions of a king. The new world order should start at home. Neither Hitler's nor a few American presidents' visions of worldwide supremacy, but an alternative solution to centralized planning or raw capitalism, a social industrial democracy that would reflect not only responsible policies, but also political equity, which Marxism and capitalist democracy have ultimately failed to do. And that was something I wrote, Return of the New World Order. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. Though it is confusedly complex and indirectly sinister, the fact that public money supports the very wealthy who have essentially impoverished much of the rest of the USA through their banks and Wall Street financial institutions, the old villains of civic socialism with bank bailouts and various other irascible schemes, not to mention the usual trillions of public cash wasted on corruptions such as wars and the like, that generally handsomely reward profiteering corporations, public programs for the poor are insidiously downsized or abolished because not enough money trickles down to poverty agencies of local governments that claim the necessity to slash budgets for programs involving the most needy, as there is not enough trickle-down capital in rampant capitalism. The old shibboleth is manifest. Capitalism for the poor, welfare for the wealthy. Happy Cinco de Mayo, which is apparently more of a holiday in the USA than in post-revolutionary Mexico. And homage to springtime sniffles.